Hello, I'm Gary Bauerman from Check-In Asia, and this is a special airline and aviation edition of the Southeast Asia Travel Show. Hello, wherever you are in the world, and thanks for listening in. On today's pod, I'll be talking about the impact of COVID-19 on the aviation and wider travel sectors in Asia Pacific with Mac Patel, Regional Director of Sales for Japan and Asia Pacific with OAG, the world's leading provider of airline flight information, intelligence, and analytics. We hope you enjoy this really broad-ranging interview that we recorded on Monday, the 4th of May. So, Mac Patel, Regional Sales Director for OAG in Japan and Asia Pacific, welcome to the Southeast Asia Travel Show.
Oh, thank you, Gary, for having me on.
How are you doing? You're down there in Singapore.
Yeah, I'm in Singapore. We've been in a circuit breaker mode for the past 4 weeks now, mm-hmm. So going into the 5th week. So basically working from home, and it's proving to be quite reasonable in terms of connecting with our colleagues and customers in the region. So far, so good.
Normally, you live in Singapore and you're based in Singapore, but you also have an office in Japan, is that correct?
Correct, that's right. So this is the JPAC region. So Singapore is our regional office, and then we've got a sub-office in Tokyo. So we've got our sales organization up in Japan as well.
Okay, well, we'll come back to that in a little bit moment, because I was going to ask you a little bit about your own travels. But I want to go back, Mac. I want to go back to... back to your childhood, and you were raised in Fiji, and you were schooled in Sydney, Australia. That's correct, isn't it?
Correct, that's right.
So when and where did travel and aviation become a part or a passion in your life?
Okay, so that goes back aviation and my passion for travel when I was around 8 years old. So a lot of that was inspired by my dad's role as a board member with Fiji's national carrier, mm-hmm. Air Pacific. And he was also involved with Fiji Visitors Bureau, and his early years as pioneer of airport duty-free retailing. So there was a lot of different elements of travel that was discussed in our house. We used to experience early day age of travel, which was very different at that time. And so it sort of grew on me. And when I went to boarding school, the aeroplane rides from Fiji to Australia, that was a bit of a novelty item 4 times a year. And I used to go plane spotting at the airport just to get inspired by different aircraft. It was the DC-10s or the 747. Early series.
Yeah.
And basically everything that I did was around aviation. So all the projects at school. So it was deeply enrooted in my so-called DNA that aviation will be something I'll follow through, whether it's at university or postgraduate, as well as my job experience.
And how were those early days of your exposure to aviation in Fiji? You mentioned that your father was involved with the national airline in duty free. What was the market like back then?
It was a different market. So we had a lot of Japanese tourists, mm-hmm. As well as Australian. And the composition today, if you look at Fiji's tourism, it's very mixed. So you've got mainland Chinese that are coming in big numbers now. So you've got expanded European as well as the North American market, and your traditional Australia and New Zealand market that's kept in pace. So there's a lot of demographic changes. Japanese tourists are coming back in small numbers now. So they've diversified back from what they were back in the 80s. And you've seen a lot of different shifts in consumer behavior patterns as well.
Yeah.
So going from luxury goods right down to the basic necessities that people buy when they go duty-free shopping, whether it's alcohol, liquor, chocolates. So all that has changed the concept of duty-free retailing at the airports as well.
Right, right. So you mentioned there that you studied in Australia, and then after that, well, since then, you've worked across Asia Pacific and also in Canada, I believe.
That's right. So I did my degree in Australia, then I worked for Qantas in New Zealand and ANZ Australia. Then after that, I moved to Montreal, Canada to work for IATA. Then after that, I was moved to Singapore. I was with IATA looking after the Asia Pacific region. And then from there, I moved to Bangkok to work for Amadeus, looking after the Middle East and Asia Pacific. Pacific region, then moved back to Singapore, and I'm with OAG for the past 3.5 years.
Right. So in those 3.5 years, Mac, you know, the travel industry, the aviation industry has changed quite a lot, especially in our region, Asia Pacific. What are some of the key changes and some of the key developments that you've noticed and which impact
your role and also the role throughout the travel industry?
So OAG, basically, we look at travel intelligence data across the travel ecosystem. So there's a lot of different trends that are changing. Travel distribution with IATA's new distribution capabilities, the NDC, that's taking hold. Online travel agencies are growing. They're developing new innovative products, solution for travelers. So we're at the heart of that. And the airline industry is also expanding. A lot of capacity was added. Low-cost carriers are becoming very dominant, especially in Asia Pacific. If you look at the development over the last 15 years, that has gone quite rapidly over that period. So I do recall about 15 years ago, a lot of people would have said low-cost airlines would not be successful in the region. But if you look at the track record, some of the development that's been done here through AirAsia, whether it's Jetstar, and a lot of developments around the Indian LCC and how that's making travel affordable for a vast majority of the travelers there. And you've seen a lot of development around North Asia as well, primarily Korea, which is flooded with LCCs. And Japan is coming into that play as well in the period.
So there's two elements there that you've discussed, really. One is sort of the development of LCCs within individual regions. So you mentioned Southeast Asia, Northeast Asia, and you also mentioned India as well. But then also the interconnectivity. We've sort of seen sort of these mid-range LCCs that have started to connect up travelers across the whole of Asia Pacific.
That's right. So you've got airlines that are doing self-connects as well, whether it's through an alliance, a value alliance, as a group of airlines that have got together. And they've started looking at interlining between each other to make a seamless travel experience to compete with the likes of AirAsia, which has different many brands scattered around the different countries. And also Jetstar linking up with their network with Qantas out of Australia. So that's been quite successful in the way different LCCs have come together either through a group or alliance or a standalone with their parent company looking at connectivity that way. And also airline within airline. So Singapore Airlines with Scoot, Cathay Pacific Group with Hong Kong Express. These are some successful examples where integration of full service carrier with a low cost airline subsidiary within the group.
So that brings us up to where the landscape was towards the end of 2019. But obviously the last 4 months with COVID-19 has thrown everything asunder. The whole industry has been, well, it's been devastated, really. When you first heard about COVID-19, when you first heard about those cases of pneumonia in Wuhan, did you get any idea that, you know, this was going to hit the aviation industry just so hard?
Not really, because the message that we got was that the event was under control and that it would be contained. So life was pretty much normal through the course of January and early parts of February. So some markets did not see any sharp decline while China was going through that downturn.
And you yourself were traveling during this period?
I was traveling right up to 13th of March. Yep. So if you look at the areas I was traveling, Indonesia and India, there were no cases reported at that time. So business was as usual. Customers were willing to see us, and everything went pretty smoothly. I took the extra precaution. I was wearing masks on the flights, but it seemed pretty normal business as usual during that period.
And as your company, you monitor the aviation statistics rigorously. You've been producing some very good reports over the last few months about, you know, just the situation as it unfolds. At what point did you start to notice that, you know, there really was a downturn happening here?
So there were two parts to it. So one was in North Asia. So that really involved China and a bit of Hong Kong. So if you look at the capacity in China as well, it's Hong Kong markets, you saw some major tapering off at the end of January. And if you look at Hong Kong itself, on the 4th of February, when Cathay Dragon cut about 90% of their flights into mainland China. So that gave us some strong signals as to what was coming. And usually some of these major hubs gives you a clear indication that if China is reducing a lot of the capacity, there will be a knock-on effect on the airline's network. So that led to approximately about 30% of Cathay Pacific Group's capacity being shrunk. during that period. And that rapidly changed over due course of 2nd of March, where it went down as far as 70%, and then it progressively declined to 93%. And if you look at Southeast Asia, where the impact came in a bit later on, capacity changes in Singapore started tapering off towards the week commencing 23rd of March, with around 77% of the flights cancelled. And a week prior to that was 36%. So you can see the way capacity has moved aggressively because of changes in traffic patterns. There was government advisories. There was a lot of cases that were coming online in different countries. So there was a lot of resistance from whether travelers or tourism industry, as well as the governments, to actually lock down their borders. So effectively, if you look at Singapore, if you close down the transit traffic, that evaporates majority of your inbound and outbound travel. So, and then if other border controls are imposed by other countries, then you have a very similar situation where passengers cannot actually travel through to get to point A to point B.
So, as I mentioned there, I've been reading the weekly updates that OAG puts out, and I've also sat in a couple of webinars, and you're very close to the industry, you monitor the statistics, you know the people involved, you know the situation as it's happening. How has this changed your business model? Because obviously the aviation industry is undergoing not just massive change right now, but this will endure into the future. How is this impacting the way that you operate?
Okay, so the essence of OAG is to provide data to the industry. And this is a significant time for the industry to see the data, what is actually played out when capacity changes, what does that mean to the destinations and tour operators, so the knock-on effect from that. So it's probably the most important part of the industry recovery that the industry and stakeholders can use to predict what sort of outcomes will come through in the next 3 months, 6 months, 9 months, and 12 months out. So capacity tends to be a good gauge in terms of what's actually happening. And if you look at some parts of China now, the domestic market, what the airlines are doing is gradually putting capacity back onto the system. And you have seen some successful signs where, if you look at the holiday peak period of outbound traffic from 30th April and 1st of May, traffic growth rate rose to -54% year over year. Mm-hmm. So if you compare that to last week, it was -62% year over year. So you can see that some of the traffic has rebounded, and there's some confidence in the market itself.
But it is a slow process. Like you mentioned, this was a holiday weekend, so we probably would have expected a much bigger uplift than that.
Correct, that's right. So considering the circumstance, I think what's happening in China is a good sign of confidence how recovery can be staged in the domestic market. And that's what we are predicting, that the recovery will be in stages, whether it's domestic, interregional, and then long haul.
Yeah, I guess one of the challenges for OAG is that, you know, these capacities are changing. It's a very dynamic situation. And you mentioned to me the other day that, you know, airlines are rescheduling very, very frequently at the moment, which normally wouldn't happen. The whole situation is in flux, but it is very, very fluid, isn't it?
Correct, yeah. So that's where we play an important role in the travel ecosystem. So getting people to better understand what's actually happening with the data from the airlines and how that can have a ripple effect on the local economies, whether it's at a government level, whether it's at a local level, whether it's a destination marketing level, so they can have a look at this type of data to predict what the outcome would be in the short, medium, and long term.
So in this, amid this dynamic situation, you're seeing projections from IATA and the ICAO about the full year, that it's going to be a pretty devastating year. There's no doubt about that. We've already seen some airlines, Virgin Australia, Air Mauritius come to mind, that have gone into administration. There's big issues now about governments bailing out flag carriers, but also perhaps some of the privately owned carriers. What do you see is going to happen here? Are more airlines going to go into administration, or do you think that we've got through the worst of it now and that, you know, hopefully there's an upward curve to come?
It's put a lot of financial burden on the airlines. So the crisis has brought a lot of impact to airlines' finances. So you will see some airlines go through administration or restructuring. So there's going to be new opportunities for consolidation, whether airlines would need to resize the network. Fleet simplification would be another option, or downsize and then grow from there. So I think from a broader recovery perspective, it will be up to individual airlines to see how what sort of support they would get from either the government or shareholders, and see how that sort of fits into the broader recovery, whether they need to park some of their planes on a longer term basis, or they see a broader recovery kick in maybe in 12 months' time. So there'll be all these strategic decisions that airlines will need to make over the next few months to see how they actually pull through.
Yeah.
And I think there'll be some core themes around restructuring of the network and fleet simplification.
So once that happens, if you have fleet simplification, if you have consolidation, if you have some of the other measures that you mentioned there, there will be a lot of spare capacity in planes, I would imagine. Do you think there'll be opportunities for entrepreneurs to set up new airlines, for example?
Yeah, you'll probably see a bit of that with Virgin Australia. So what's happening through them under the administration that they're going through, you may see some entrepreneurs come in with a different type of business model that might be suited for the Australian market. So you've got a full service carrier at the moment. You've got a low cost base as well. And if you look at the origin of Virgin Australia through its roots, it was actually an LCC originally. So you could have different models that would fit into the new entrepreneurs that will actually buy the airline and sort of take that opportunity and grow that out to ease some of that capacity, overcapacity that existed in the Australian market for some time. And there was a lot of the capacity wars that were going on for a couple of years' time. So I think that would sort of rationalize some of this capacity in some of the markets like Australia. And you may see some of that in the Asia Pacific as well as Southeast Asia, where there's an influx of LCC activities. So, and key markets will hold, whether it's domestic that will grow faster than some of the intra-regional as well as international. And the big question then becomes, what's the role of long-haul, low-cost carriers? How will that shape up over the next 12 months?
Well, thank you for mentioning Australia there, because you've actually preempted my next question, because I actually wanted to turn to Australia. It's a very interesting case study, particularly for Southeast Asia. It's a popular destination for Northeast Asian travellers and Southeast Asian travellers as well. Now, the government has made some quite strong comments, probably stronger than most other governments in terms of how long its borders will stay closed. It said that they won't allow international flights for the next few months at least. Do you think that's the right policy? And do you think we will see this similar approach from other governments over the next sort of few weeks here in Asia Pacific?
So that's a good question, because every government is trying to work its way through the situation, and it's just one way forward. So there's other factors involved, airport processes, virus tracking, immunization, whether you need to get a medical certification prior to travel. And that the question there is, how many days out do you need that? Is it 48 hours? So people will need to plan their travel pretty well in advance to ensure that they go through a formality. It sort of reminds me of the 80s, where you had to get a vaccine before you traveled and you had to hold this different documentation. So we may see a bit of that coming through until we get a vaccination for this COVID-19. And you just never know for sure what was a good or indeed not so good strategy. But the priority of any government is to protect its citizens. And if this is the view of Australia, then it's their call, basically.
Yeah. You mentioned earlier in a previous answer about the initial development will come through domestic travel. We've started to see also Australia as a case study of these sort of regional, sort of geographical pairings that might happen. There's this trans-Tasman bubble where Australia and New Zealand might open some of their airspace to each other's airlines. Perhaps that would be extended into the Pacific Islands as well. I think Hong Kong said last week that it would look at allowing travellers from China, Korea, Japan, the sort of Northeast Asia sphere. I mean, is that, as well as domestic, is it going to become very regionalised, do you think?
I think the concept of travel bubbles is interesting, because that would allow different governments to say, look, I feel confident that some of these countries that we have an agreement with, where people can travel to and from and within, there's a sign of endorsement that things are under control. There's a process in which you would get screened as you travel through. And I think you will see some of these bubbles forming up. And for markets like Hong Kong, as well as Singapore, where there's no domestic market, that will be very interesting because you need to kickstart tourism. There's a lot of pent up demand that's sitting here. People are working at home. There's a lot of frustration in terms of how much they can go out, the social network. So that kind of opens that up. So some creative solution through some government initiative will allow that to sort of open up the travel bubbles between different countries that people can travel to and from.
Yeah. I mean, here in ASEAN, we've, in the last week or so, the ASEAN tourism ministers have put forward the idea that there will be a greater regional approach to this. But I mean, the interesting thing about ASEAN, it has a lot of intra-regional travel. It has a lot of travel from the greater part of Asia Pacific as well, but a lot of connectivity for outbound travel, especially through the Middle East. So there's a very complex market here. It's not just regionalized in terms of developing the future, is it? This is a very much a short-term way of looking at it.
Correct. So as long as international markets are closed, it's going to be very difficult for the major hubs to operate effectively. So if you look at an example of Singapore as a hub airport, it's acting as a pivot point between destinations to the east and west, and ensuring there's both a good balance of markets and capacity either side of that. So if, for example, if Australia is still closed and Europe is closed, so you don't get any traffic coming through Changi, but if one market on either side is open and one or the other one is closed, then it's still a problematic. So you need to have good coordination between the two markets to actually make it all effective. And if you look at Southeast Asia, so we talked earlier about capacity in Hong Kong and China that was effectively down quite a large significant percentage. So if you go to the OAG blog, you will see a matrix where it shows you the global capacity schedule flight changes year over year. And you'll see that Hong Kong took a big hit around 2nd of March. It was down somewhere around 70%. But in the interim, Singapore, being in the Southeast Asia region and being the pivot between East and West traffic, you did see some of these markets like Indonesia, Australia, Europe, that were still effectively operating on a normal basis. So they were open and you saw a lot of traffic. So Singapore Airlines, for example, did not reduce their capacity aggressively until the week of 23rd of March, when things were developing further and faster in the markets where they were operating. So there were some trends in terms of how hub airports will open up, and that will require a lot of different countries to be sort of certified as COVID-19 free, or it's come under control by certain measurement that will allow people to travel within that travel bubble there.
We're starting to see a little bit of movement. We've seen some, particularly in the past week, weekend, in some markets, Vietnam, Korea, China. Malaysia's opening up back to work today. Flights are still extremely limited. Is this the progress that we would have expected at this point? Do you think we'll see a lot more opening up in the next couple of weeks, 2 to 3 weeks?
Yeah, so the last week was interesting because you had the Golden Week in China, Korea, Japan. So Korea was kind of interesting, where there's a lot of air travel between Seoul and Jeju Island. And that showed some positive movement there in terms of capacity as well as passenger bookings. So it's early days at the moment to see if that full recovery or a partial recovery is in order. But I would think that domestic, once you get good confidence with domestic and these new processes that airlines are adopting and implementing, whether it's acceptable to the travelers to go through the process and how that impacts air travel is closely to be seen. And I'm sure that a lot of authorities out there will be monitoring that quite closely to see how that's evolving.
I want to turn to India, because I know, Mac, that you spend a lot of time, you've concentrated quite significantly on the Indian market in the past couple of years. Now, Indian outbound travel was starting to gain quite strong momentum into Southeast Asia, notably into Thailand, Singapore, Malaysia, Bali, and Indonesia as well. What's happened there in terms of the airline and the travel sector? Has it been weakened? Has it been damaged for the longer term, or do you think it will bounce back?
Actually, the Indian outbound market was very promising. So there's a lot of capacity that was going into parts of Southeast Asia. So Singapore has always been quite a favorite destination for the Indian markets. So that was traditionally very strong, whether it's through transit market or a holiday segment. And Singapore tourism at large has evolved greatly. So it's got the resort world, it's got Universal Studios, Marina Bay Sands, there's Gardens by the Bay, the zoo. And that's kind of attractive from a family destination perspective. And the Indians actually like that type of concept. And the other one was Thailand. That's a rapid growth in unserved destinations like Phuket. So airlines actually put all capacity in there. And the reason for that was purely because Thailand tourism and the government actually saw potential in tourism from key source markets, and India was one of them. And so that led to visa-free travel from the India market, and that's helped dramatically in terms of proximity, the travel time. I know some examples where people living in Calcutta were traveling to Bangkok for the weekend just to have a short break, because it was just an easy way to travel and it was very short. And if you look at the Chinese market, that constituted about 28% of Thailand tourism in 2019. So if you look at the perspective of two key source markets that are coming into Southeast Asia, that represents a lot of opportunities in terms of how tourism is created, what opportunities lie in there in terms of secondary markets that exist in China and India. And you've got aircraft technology now that can actually do non-stop narrow-body services into tier two cities. So that's becoming more affordable from the airline's perspective, as well as the outbound source market's affordability. Because there's a lot of middle class that's emerging out of these two markets. And when you have disposable income, people will be willing to travel. But that sort of puts a bit of shadow on what's actually happening today, because there'll be less disposable income for people to travel on. So the recovery could be a bit phased out over a period of time until people get their jobs back, or there's more money in the bank for people to do other things related to leisure, travel and activity.
So as we move forward, one of the key elements, not just for aviation, but for the entire travel sector, is safety and health. Everybody who's going to travel, whether traveling for business or leisure, is going to be very, very aware of their own personal vulnerability. We've come through something that nobody really expected they would have to deal with. How are the airlines going to deal with this going forward? We've seen a couple that are introducing compulsory testing. We've seen AirAsia has introduced sort of protective body suits for its cabin staff. Do you think that there will be sort of cross-industry operating procedures, or do you think airlines will take their own way through this?
I think there'll be a coordination with the airports and airlines. So there will be a stringent health screening at different airports. So the tricky question now is, if you go through one airport, do you need to get tested when you actually arrive at the other end? So there definitely needs a bit of government and different stakeholders to work that out. And so I think from that perspective, airlines and airports, as well as health authorities of different countries, will be involved in making sure that they have the safest methods of implementing something that is traveler-sensitive outcome and something that's accepted by the industry and it doesn't prolong. I've heard from some sources that you would need to be at the airport about 4 hours before departure to actually go through the formalities.
So it's a fine balancing act, isn't it? There's these essential elements to make people feel safer, to make sure that health and safety is, you know, there is no more spread of this virus while people are flying. But there's also the element of whether they actually put people off, whether it's just too stringent, whether time delays will be too long. You know, if you're going to board a plane where cabin crew are wearing protective suits, is that going to veer the other way of actually putting people off?
Well, the jury's out on that PPE outfits that airlines are looking at. So if you look at North America, the airlines have implemented a mask for the cabin crew. And that PPE equipment was actually on one AirAsia flight, I think it was,
right,
in Philippines. So that was a trial. And if that sort of goes through successfully, then they'll probably implement it. And if passengers are kind of spooked by that, I think the airlines will look at different reduction in terms of whether it's masks or gloves, which the crew were doing before the pandemic started.
Well, Mac, it's been fascinating to talk to you. Before we finish, I want to just ask you one more question. You've touched on various sub-markets throughout the region and also internationally there, but I just want to put you on the spot here about the recovery in Asia Pacific. And what are we looking at in general terms here? You know, we've looked at specific markets, but the overall recovery, we're seeing various predictions about, you know, it'll take 18 months, 20 months, 2 years to get back to anywhere near last year's level. What's your gauge about, you know, how long this recovery will actually take?
Actually, the way I see it is recovery in the market will come in different waves, for which we will see regional traffic recovery in a gradual manner. So this will all depend on how quickly the virus is contained and how much border controls are going to be eased, and also new health screening processes being implemented. So there's a lot of variables at play, which will require a coordinated approach amongst key stakeholders to determine how fast the recovery will come. And also airports, airlines will also play an important role in educating the travelers about the cleanliness and some of the procedures that they're taking to making sure that health and safety is of paramount importance when they actually travel on the plane. And there's always this debate about the middle seat. So this, whether you should do it, you shouldn't do it. And if you look at the SARS experience of 2003, a lot of airlines were saying that we have a fantastic filtration system in the aircraft that actually prevents the virus actually circulating around. So there's key messages within the airline's communication, or whether it's an airport communication where there's going to be a lot of people that mix together, as to how they actually promote that to the traveling public will be of crucial importance.
And finally, on a personal note, Mac, you're a frequent flyer. You're traveling all the time. And obviously, you're in Singapore at the moment. The airlines aren't operating. Once you can fly again, where will you be going next for business or for pleasure?
Generally, where our customer businesses are. So Japan would be one of the key areas. I've got my team there. And seeing the team in person is very important, as well as Japanese customers paying them a visit face-to-face. That will still be required in this region, purely because it's more personable. There's that face-to-face meeting, you exchange ideas, different relationships are built. And I think technology does not replace that in a lot of the work that's done in Asia Pacific.
So it could be a while until you're hopping onto a flight to Bali for a holiday?
Yeah, that's going to be some time, actually. Mm-hmm. So we've got my son's school holidays will be coming up in June. So I think we'll be stranded this time around. So we were planning to go to Europe this year. So that's on hold, obviously. And we'll probably just be in Singapore till things recover and maybe decide on December holiday if things sort of settle down, and take it from there.
Mac, it's been a pleasure talking to you. Thanks very, very much for your insights. It's been absolutely brilliant. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you,
and great to speak to you.
Thank you for having me.